From Community Public Radio, this is the CPR News. From New York, I'm Don DeBar.
What's really important here is the realignment of politics. And the left wing, or the traditional left, has been potentially fractured and shattered by this.
That was Patrick Henningsen, one of the many journalists and political commentators who've been analyzing what happened last week with the historic Brexit referendum in the UK. He was speaking on the RT program, Crosstalk.
You have all these Eurosceptic Remainers who are basically siding with the IMF, the World Bank, the ECB, all the institutions that have bludgeoned countries like Greece and Spain and have made the poor South in Europe much more disadvantaged economically than the rich North. So this is a major realignment. This is also what happened in Scotland as well in the wake of their referendum, a total wiping of the board of national politics. And I believe this is a major coup which has happened politically in Britain in this last week that a lot of people aren't realizing the full effects of yet.
George Galloway, former member of parliament in the UK and longtime political activist, likewise sees the failure of the left to identify with the demands of working class voters on issues that they believe relate to their very ability to survive. He said that whatever political advantage those on the left in the Labour Party thought they would gain by opposing Brexit would evaporate within days.
The very people for whom Jeremy Corbyn was out campaigning, I believe against his better instincts, when he campaigned for a Remain vote, those very people who most believe in the Remain cause are now planning on Tuesday to stab him in the back and create a crisis inside the Labour Party at a time when the Tory Party is falling apart.
Galloway hosts the RT program Sputnik. He spoke with Alex Graham, former president of the RMT union, who believes trade unions have lost confidence in their ability to defend members' rights and that an exit from the EU could help them get that back.
I think there's a great deal of discussion in the media in the immediate aftermath of this tremendous vote of what it represents in terms of different segments of the population, and you'll see various commentators talking about how young people voted for the European Union or Scottish people voted for the European Union. But the clearest single division that runs right the way through this referendum vote is that working class people could not be persuaded to vote for the European Union, and in many cases voted against it in massive numbers. I mean, the polling numbers in working class constituencies, working class areas, were exceptionally high. And there were anecdotal stories of, you know, places like Basildon in Essex, places in the Northeast, where there was very, very heavy polling in solid Labour heartland seats in the Northeast, such as Sunderland, one of the first results to come in. There was very, very heavy voting by working people rejecting the European Union, even in Glasgow.
And yet the official trade union bureaucracy, for the most part, painted the EU as the workers' friend. Why didn't the workers see it that way?
Well, because it's a completely untenable point of view, and we're not living in the dark ages. We're living where people have televisions, smartphones, and wide access through the internet to a variety of sources. And it's very, very clear, whether you look at the plight of sub-Saharan African refugees perishing in the Mediterranean because of Fortress Europe, and because their economies have been destroyed by the European Union dumping cheap subsidized agricultural products on their countries, or whether you look at the policies of austerity, which the European Commission and the European Central Bank have imposed on Greece, Portugal, Ireland, but also are part of the European Union treaties. It's very, very clear that the European Union has been attacking welfare states, attacking working people from Lisbon to Tallinn. You know, you can see it right the way across the piece. And working people, whatever some politicians might think, aren't stupid. And there's been this confection of Project Fear, which has been particularly promoted by a lot of left-wing supporters of the Remain campaign, that a vote to come out of the European Union was going to lead to some sort of fantasy coalition between Nigel Farage, a man who has one MP who can't stand him, and Boris Johnson. I mean, Boris Johnson couldn't open a supermarket without being attacked by a Tory MP. He is reviled by at least 50% of his own parliamentary party, if not more. The fact is, this vote was never going to create a stable right-wing Tory post-Brexit government. It was only likely to have one outcome, and that was to bring the Conservative government down. And anyone who had any kind of objective analysis of what was likely to happen could see that that was true. And yet there have been legions of well-paid left-wing political commentators who have been telling voters exactly the opposite.
Here in the U.S., many on the left are similarly pointing to immigrant bashing and Islamophobia among those supporting Republican presumptive nominee Donald Trump as reasons that they will back instead one of the founders of neoliberal politics in the U.S., Hillary Clinton, who also has the backing of most of the same neocon elites who themselves have used immigrant bashing, Islamophobia, and racism as political tools. But like Galloway, Graham, and many others in the UK, not everyone on the left in the US is buying in either. Howie Hawkins has been an organizer in the movements for peace, justice, labor, the environment, and independent politics since the late 1960s. He was the Green Party's 2014 candidate for governor of New York, regaining state ballot access for the Greens after receiving 5% of the vote. He recently wrote a piece at counterpunch.org with the title Safe States, Inside, Outside, and Other Liberal Illusions. We spoke with him via telephone Friday.
There are a lot of elaborate schemes to try to be inside and outside the Democratic Party as some kind of transition to independent politics. But every time a group tries inside and outside, they end up inside. Because to be inside and accepted so you can actually participate, you have to accept the rules of inside. Bernie Sanders did that by saying at the beginning he would endorse the Democratic nominee, whoever it was, and that was the price he had to pay to get into the debates and even onto the ballots of Democratic primaries. If he had said, oh, I don't know, I may support him or her or I may not, they wouldn't have let him get on the ballot because they'd have said, you're not a Democrat. So, you know, there's a lot of talk about an inside-outside strategy. At one point, coming out of the Rainbow Coalition, there were a lot of people, you know, people who may remember Dave Dellinger and Arthur Kanoy and Ron Daniels and people like that said that's what we should do with the Rainbow Coalition, support progressives inside the Democratic Party, and if we lose the primary, then run against them independently. And what happened was that whole movement ended up inside the Democratic Party. And then by the time you get to Kucinich, the group that came out of that was Progressive Democrats of America, and they talk about being inside and outside, but outside is really outside on the street, where you're basically lobbying Democrats who are inside, in office. It's kind of a militant form of lobbying. But when they're inside, they're running in the Democratic Party.
And Kucinich is actually on the outside himself now, isn't he?
Ironically, that's right. He tried to raise some progressive demands inside the Democratic Party, and he got gerrymandered out of his district, where he was pitted against Marcy Kaptur, and she won, and he was out.
Yep. So what about safe states? That's another one of those things.
Yeah. There was, you know, in after Nader ran in 2000, the Democrats really tried to explain their loss and blame Ralph Nader. Now, of course, the Republicans stole the election. Before the vote, they used computerized racial profiling to eliminate tens of thousands of black voters from the rolls in Florida who would likely have voted Democrat. And then it was a real close result, and they basically were outmaneuvered by the Republicans. And in the end, the Supreme Court said, stop the recount, Bush won. And they passed had a decision, Bush v. Gore, which they said it should never be a precedent because it was a strict party line vote among the Supreme Court justices. It was just, you know, the Republicans confirming their theft of the election. And the Democrats, instead of fighting the Republicans, have decided they would blame Nader. So in the early 2000s, there were Greens who said, oh, geez, all our friends are, you know, saying bad things about us. In the peace movement, as Bush went into Iraq, in the environmental movement and so forth. And so they pushed Nader away, and they said, we're going to run in 2004 only in the states that either Democrats or Republicans have in the bag. We're not going to compete in the battleground states or the swing states, as they're sometimes called. So they'd only compete in the safe states. And David Cobb ran for the nomination against Nader with that program. And he won narrowly in a convention where the rules and what happened is was controversial. Let's just leave it at that. But David found, David Cobb found he really couldn't run safe states as a practical matter because, for example, Greens in Pennsylvania, a difficult state to get on the ballot, knocked themselves out to get the petition done. They were successful. Yeah. And then, David couldn't tell him, well, I'm not going to campaign after all that work you did in Pennsylvania.
Because he alienated them all.
So he found as a practical matter, he couldn't run safe states and still have the support of the Greens and the party. So he switched his strategy to smart states, which meant I'll run wherever the Greens want me to. And, of course, Greens in every state wanted him to run in their state. So that has been resurfaced from a group called Socialist Alternative, who elected Shama Sawant to the city council in Seattle. And they've raised this as a way of, maybe Bernie Sanders could keep running as an independent without jeopardizing Hillary Clinton's chances. But, of course, that really is saying we're not serious. We're not challenging the Democrats, who are the, really the corporate center now. I mean, you have all kinds of Wall Street people and military people coming, getting behind Clinton because Trump is kind of crazy. So that's not serious independent politics. And you end up inside the Democratic Party providing support for the party that does everything you oppose. So,
again,
it's just not a smart strategy.
And you were talking about the effort that people put into getting a presidential candidate on the ballot. I remember in 2004 being in Texas, and the threshold was 60-some-odd thousand signatures, good signatures, meaning 100-and-something thousand signatures had to be collected by the beginning of May, first week in May or something. In Pennsylvania, if memory serves, there was a guy who ended up with like a $60,000 judgment against him because the Democratic Party came after him. And so there's really a high cost in terms of effort and even putting your behind on the line for this stuff to have somebody walk away.
Well, that guy was Ralph Nader in 2004.
Yeah, that's right.
And in 2006, I believe it was Carl Romanelli who got on the ballot to run for U.S. Senate. And the law in Pennsylvania said if you make a frivolous challenge to a petition, you can be fined for the court costs of that challenge. And the judge, who was a hack for the Democratic Party in Pennsylvania, flipped the law around and said, if you submit frivolous signatures, now you have a lot of volunteers, some of whom are paid, and some of them cheat. They write in Mickey Mouse, or somebody they're collecting signatures from writes in Mickey Mouse. So you're going to get some bad signatures. And the judge used that to fine Nader $80,000 and Carl Romanelli $100,000, which basically means if you want to run as a independent or third party candidate in Pennsylvania, you're basically putting your house on the line. Because what happened there was, the Democrats ironically hired a bunch of Republican lawyers from a white shoe law firm in Philadelphia. These Philadelphia lawyers did the dirty work for the Democrats. And, it really cost Nader and Carl Romanelli. And that those cases actually are still being contested. At one point, the courts in Pennsylvania froze some of Nader's assets to get that money.
Okay, so far we've done the inside-outside, which, as Dennis Kucinich, usually leaves you outside after a little time inside, and the safe state strategy. There's also the party-within-the-party illusion. Let's talk about that.
Well, that's basically the idea that we can reform the Democratic Party. Probably the most prominent expression of that strategy was the realignment strategy, which some socialists around Max Shackman and then Michael Harrington started talking about in the 1950s as the Socialist Party really abandoned independent politics and started looking to be the socialist wing of the New Deal coalition inside the Democratic Party. And their argument was, we push the Dixiecrats out of the Democratic Party and bring the progressive Republicans in, and we will have a majority party of liberals, labor, and blacks, which would be a governing majority. And, of course, we've had that realignment. The Dixiecrats went to the Republican Party. What progressive Republicans were still around by the end of the 60s have gone into the Democratic Party. So we've had the realignment, and what it does has done is shifted the whole spectrum to the right, with the Republicans becoming, you know, the most right-wing party we've had probably since the Democrats were the party of white supremacy and undid Reconstruction, you know, in the 1870s. And the Republican Party and the Democratic Party has become the center-right party of corporate America. And so realignment happened, but it didn't work the way the theorists thought. So, you know, there have been numerous efforts by the labor movement, by the civil rights movement, by the peace movement in 2004 when they got behind Kerry, who reporting for duty, he wanted a bigger surge than Bush got. And he was the candidate of the peace movement, which instead of continuing with the slogan "End the War," had the slogan against the Bush agenda,
which basically
dissolved the peace movement as a peace movement and became an appendage of the Democratic Party, which is a party of war.
Right.
So, you know, you go into the Democratic Party to change it, and it changes you. That's been the historical experience.
Yeah, I've heard the Roach Motel reference used a few times. Before we go further, on both the point of the party within a party and on all of these things, the right wing has mastered the skill of exercising power from the margins. I remember here in New York, for example, I'm sure you remember as well, the Right to Life Party would not endorse a Republican, and the Conservative Party did the same thing unless they were like front and center with their agenda, and it meant we're going to get a Democratic governor, and you're going to learn your lesson, and you'll be back here next time, and that's how it operated. And yet, the Greens didn't do that. I mean, there was a myth that Florida was swung by Nader and the Greens, and that's what got Bush in there. We know different. Nader told the truth about what happened. It was obvious to people looking at what happened, but there was no, you know, like the right wing would have said basically, yeah, you're right, and we're going to do it again unless you do the following. How come there's a reluctance to try to exercise that kind of power at the margins among the left?
I don't know. It was the first principle of socialist politics to be independent of the bourgeois capitalist parties, that the working people had to have their own party. And that came out of hard lessons from the revolutions in 1848. There was a revolution that spread all across Europe and into even South America, Brazil, and Colombia, trying to expand the franchise to the working people. And in both cases, they were fighting mainly the old landed elites that controlled state power. And their allies were the middle classes, the small businesses and the bigger businesses and the professional classes. And what they found out in that alliance in 1848 was the middle classes, once they got the franchise, said later for the working class.
Right.
And the working class had to fight for the franchise on its own in Europe and in Latin America, and it's still doing that in many parts of the world. The difference in the United States was we started with some universalistically expressed rights in the Declaration of Independence and in the Constitution, even though it was a racist system with the slavery system and the segregation system. The general statements were universalistic, which enabled people like Martin Luther King to appeal to those ideals to extend them to black people and working people too in the Jacksonian area, where they got rid of the property qualifications. So you didn't need a class-based party to win the franchise. Now, as we got into the industrial era, and working people and the farmers who were getting their land taken from them through all kinds of schemes and becoming sharecroppers began to form the populist farmer labor parties and the Greenback Labor Party and the People's Party in the late 19th century, we began to get independent class-based politics And that extended into the Socialist Party around Eugene Debs in the early part of the 20th century. But what happened in 1936 was, at that time, the communists were one of the strong parties on the left, and they formed a popular front inside the Democratic Party with the New Deal Coalition. And that was very popular, and it really defeated the Socialist Party, which pretty soon followed suit, as I was talking about with the realignment strategy. So what we've lost on the left in this country is the sense that of that first principle of socialist politics, class independence. And so we've gone through wave after wave of reform movements, the Black Liberation Movement, the anti-war movements, the environmental movements, and they all see the relationship to the Democratic Party as a question of tactics, not principle. And they go into the Democratic Party, and because they don't have that independent option, that exit strategy, they get taken for granted. So the politics have generally moved to the right on in this country, on everything but social equality. That's where the meritocratic ideology has been extended to blacks and women and gays, and they are free to compete in a society that's becoming more and more unequal. So a few will rise to the top, but the masses of us are losing ground. And that's where we're at. And until, you know, those of us who are being taken for granted by the political establishment don't form our own party, put our own program out there, organize independently so that we're not... What happens when you go in the Democratic Party, if you're on the left, is you disappear. I mean, we really haven't had a left that for a long time with its own distinct voice and program that people have to deal with. That was different in the late 19th century with the farmer labor populist parties and in the early 20th century with the Socialist Party. They really set the agenda. The money question, you know, the money trust and the call for greenbacks, among other things, was the big debate in the late 19th century when both the Republican and Democratic parties were gold standard hard money parties that were immiserating the farmers in particular, but also the manufacturers. And then in the 20th century, a lot of the immediate demands of the Socialist Party were adopted in part by the New Deal. And that's because they were an independent voice and they had to be accounted for, and they got substantial votes. They elected thousands and thousands of local officials. The farmer labor populist parties elected senators, congressmen, you know, dozens of them, and took over the state legislatures of Kansas and North Carolina in the 1890s for a two-year term. So, you know, they were a real force to be reckoned with. By abandoning independent politics, the left has really disappeared as a voice. It's a pressure group without leverage inside the Democratic Party. That's where we're at.
And you do suggest a couple of tactical moves that the Democrats within the party, the left inside the Democratic Party could take, including grabbing mailing lists and organizing themselves with to raise funds.
Yeah, I did that at that point, acknowledging that a lot of the people that supported Bernie Sanders are going to try to reform the Democratic Party. And I said, you know, that's not my advice, but if you're going to do it, at least do two things. One is make Bernie share the list. I think I had a slogan, you know, free the list, exclamation point. And secondly, so that you can, you know, then organize locally, independently from the bottom up. And the other thing is to form real organizations with, you know, membership. I mean, one of the great things Sanders proved is that there are millions of people that will support with small donations a campaign for real reform, and use that same basis to form local chapters with dues-paying members, democratically structured, so that there's accountability from the bottom up. And so that was my advice to them, and I think what they will find is what, for example, the Sanders people found at the state Democratic committee meeting yesterday here in New York State, where, or I guess it was Wednesday, we're in Friday now, but, you know, the chair said we're nominating Andrew Cuomo to be the chair of the Democratic delegation, the New York delegation to the Democratic convention. And the Sanders people wanted to nominate somebody. And they were basically, you know, ignored. They tried to get the floor and they were just gaveled through. And so it was just rammed down their throats. And that's what they can expect, I think, even if they do get well organized. And those of us in the Green Party are ready to welcome them anytime they say, you know, this is not worth beating our head bloody against a brick wall.
You know, Andrew Cuomo is an interesting choice for that, given his history of dabbling in at least facially independent politics. You could ask Ray Harding about the value of working with Andy Cuomo.
Oh, yeah, when he got stuck on the liberal line and killed it. But that was a death well-deserved, because the Liberal Party was a fusion party, not a independent party. And you know, originally it was, you know, liberal Democrats who wanted to be a pressure group inside the Democratic Party. But by the time Ray Harding was running it, he was trading the nominations, for example, to Giuliani for jobs for his kids.
Right.
And it just was a corrupt little ballot line.
Yeah, and as soon as Cuomo became Attorney General that year, one of the first targets of prosecution for corruption was Ray Harding.
Yeah, big irony there.
Yeah. So you know, on this before we go to lesser evilism, on the point about the Sanders people in particular, and more, I think, more relevantly, on the point of exercising power at the margins, you know, lesser evilism is the thing that's held up as it's the antidote to the left exercising power at the margins. In other words, if the left were to say, okay, we have the decisive vote, unless you do this, that, or the other thing, we're going to sit on our hands, and you're going to lose, and we'll be back here in 4 years or next year or whatever. And that's what the left has been reluctant to do, and that's what Nader got blamed for doing in 2000. But here we are with lesser evilism, with the evils being the most evil choices we've ever had.
Well, the logic of lesser evilism is to let everything keep drifting to the right. I mean, the classic case was when the Social Democrats of Germany decided to back von Hindenburg, an arch-conservative, against Hitler rather than run their own candidate in 1932.
Right.
And they won. With the socialist support, Hindenburg won. And he appointed Hitler chancellor. And when Hindenburg died, Hitler had all the power.
Yep.
So that's a case where the lesser evil led right to the greater evil.
Right.
And that's the logic, if it's not so extreme, that happens. We, you know, the liberal left in this country keeps supporting the Democrats. You know, look at the Kerry example. Instead of supporting the anti-war candidates that year, which was Ralph Nader and Peter Camejo, his vice presidential running mate, they mostly went for Kerry, who was saying, I can fight the war in Iraq better than George Bush. And, you know, so you ended up really angry at Bush for starting this stupid war, and then you're supporting a candidate who says, I'm going to fight the stupid war better.
Right.
I mean, that's so self-defeating. You know, the best way to fight evil, let's look at it at this year. You know, you want to fight the right? You're going to rely on Hillary Clinton? I mean, what's the whole history of the Clintons? It's triangulation, accommodation to the right, whether it's, you know, racist laws that, you know, led to the expansion of the incarceral state, or the repeal of welfare that did, you know, was so devastating when we hit this recession in 2008 to poor people. You know, when Clinton went after Sister Souljah at the Rainbow Coalition convention to send a signal to white voters. That's the Clintons. And now we're being told we're going to rely on her to fight the right. And, you know, who's really backing her? All the military-industrial complex.
Right.
You know, Snowcroft came out for Clinton a day or two ago.
Yep.
Max Boot, an arch, you know, militarist, is behind Hillary Clinton. You know, Kagan and Nuland, these neocons, you know, they expect to play a big role in the Clinton administration. That's foreign policy. Wall Street wants her.
Right.
You know, does anybody really believe she's going to fight the trade agreements that she was sort of forced by Sanders to say she was opposed when she was in the State Department, she was promoting them, you know, the
right.
Trans-Pacific Partnership.
Right.
I mean, you can go down the line. You know, it's the idea that we need to elect her to fight the right. She is the right. The only way to get out of this bind is to start speaking and acting for ourselves and building a movement that, you know, gets a lot of votes and has to be reckoned with. And then you've got some power.
And that's all the news we have for you right now. For Community Public Radio, I'm Don DeBar in New York. Thanks for listening.